Good evening. Is the sound okay? Thank you. So, about 3 months ago or so, I got a new friend. It's a very cute one. It's a cat. And this cat was just roaming on the streets of Richmond, Virginia, where I live. And he decided to jump into the car of my sister-in-law. And she was working on her car at the time. And turned out this cat was stray, no collar, no chip, not neutered. And so my sister-in-law put all these messages up on Facebook, neighborhood Facebook and whatnot, to find the owner, but no result. So this was a very cute and cuddly cat, so my wife and I were thinking like, oh, maybe we should adopt him. So we did, which was a huge step in our relationship, of course. You know, nothing compared to getting married and stuff. So we called our new friend, we called him Mita, which means friend. So Mita turned out to be indeed very cuddly and cute. Now that we got to know him a little better. But there are these moments that he transforms from his cute cuddliness into this tantrum-throwing toddler. And that's when food is at play. So every time at mealtime, he is just getting all restless and agitated, and he's attacking the houseplants. And so when we go in the kitchen to make his food, we need to close the door because else we just, you know, won't be able to get him any food because he's just so on top of us. So we lock him out of the kitchen and then get his food ready. But in the meanwhile, he starts meowing like his limbs are being sawed off or something. So, and then when we finally let him in, probably for him it seems like an eternity, then he just gulps his food in as if he never had any food. And then when he's finished, he's back to his sweetness. So, yeah, Mita the cat has many virtues and qualities. Like he has a lot of metta and a lot of virya energy, a lot of aditana, determination. But there's one thing that he lacks, which is, maybe you can tell, patience. So maybe at times we are all just a little bit like Mita, impatient and throwing our inner tantrum, maybe not so much outside. But so today, topic is patience. What is it? How to cultivate it? How to work with it? So, since Mita won't listen to my Dharma talks, I thought I'd give you all a Dharma talk on patience. So, patience is one of the 10 paramis. Don talked about Nekamma, renunciation earlier, which is also one of the 10 paramis. So she might have mentioned already that it's often translated as perfections. And I thought this translation might not really work for everyone, especially those with tendencies to want to be perfect. So I thought I'd reassure you, because this term comes from the time of the Buddha. And when he wasn't awakened yet, he was thinking like, oh, what quality should I develop in order to become a Buddha? And he realized he had to develop these 10 qualities. That's at least how he got, how it's in the texts. So to attain Buddhahood, he had to perfect these 10 qualities. He had to cultivate them to the extent that they are perfect. So for us, we don't need to attain Buddhahood. We can just go for arahatship, like Anushka was talking about the other day. And that's way easier. So may not sound like it, but it is. And then we don't have to perfect all these perfections. We can just merely develop them to the extent that they are supportive for our awakening. So even also patience, we don't have to perfect it. We just, you know, need to have it as a quality in our heart and mind so that it can support our awakening. And patience is actually closely related to equanimity. And the past 2 days, we've been practicing equanimity. So you've also, in that sense, indirectly also cultivated some patience already in this retreat. And just besides that, you need a lot of patience to even come on a retreat like this. Like just living together with 100 other people, you know, that requires a lot of patience. And I would think that if your patience parami, kanti in Pali, your kanti parami was not developed, then you probably would be, you know, elbowing yourself to the front of the line at the lunch, or you would be like super annoyed if other people would be in the bathroom that you have to share and stuff like that. So we already have this parami in us to some extent. Else we wouldn't be able to function here. So what is kanti actually? Often translated as patience. But other translations are tolerance, endurance, composure, forbearance. And I found somewhere that it literally means unaffected by. Kanti means unaffected by or able to withstand. And so looking at this, you might be able to see that connection with equanimity. Equanimity is also a way of being unaffected by and being able to withstand. So there's this person, Acharya Dhammapala, and he wrote a treatise on the paramis, so all the 10. And he describes patience in that treatise too. So he says, patience has the characteristic of acceptance. Its function is to endure the desirable and undesirable. Its manifestation is tolerance or non-opposition. Seeing things as they really are is its proximate cause. But this quote touches actually on many facets of patience. And for a big chunk of this talk, I will be going over these different facets. So first, the facets of acceptance. Accepting things as they are is the opposite of impatience. When we are impatient, we want things to be different than they are. And when we are patient, we can be with the circumstances as they are. And in our practice, you might recognize that sometimes it comes up that we don't really accept what is going on. So we don't want to be restless, we want to be peaceful. Or we don't want all these thoughts to happen, or we don't want the bodily pain. And so accepting our practice just as it is very powerful. And accepting where we are in our practice is also very powerful. Like yesterday, was it yesterday? We had the talk, no, the day before yesterday, on the 4 stages of awakening, accepting maybe that we're not yet there is important. And there's this poem from the Theragatha, the poems of the enlightened monks. And this is the Venerable Thalaputta, talking about this. He says, when will I, serene and mindful, understand the 4 truths that were realized by the great hermit and are so very hard to see? When will it be? Oh, when will I not be distraught because of criticism, nor elated because of praise? When will it be? Oh, when will I discern the aggregates and the infinite varieties of phenomena, both internal and external, as no more than wood, grass, and creepers? When will it be? And he goes on like this for quite a while. It's quite a long poem. So we can really see the struggle that he had to go through trying to attain awakening. Or maybe we can relate to that a little bit. A longing for awakening. So it might be good to know that it's not that everyone who heard like one syllable that the Buddha spoke attained awakening. And there were people there in that time that also needed to practice just like us, and we were longing to progress in their practice. So accepting where we are can be really helpful. Cultivating this patience for the progress of the path, letting it unfold in its own time. So Acariya Dhammapala also mentions the facet of endurance, the next facet. He mentions enduring the desirable and the undesirable. And that's the function of patience, that's what he says. So usually we think mostly about having to endure the undesirable, but he talks about enduring the desirable too. So when we encounter desirable, what happens, right? We crave, we want, and cling. And craving has been named so many times in this hall. So when it comes up, we can endure this mind state as well. We can endure this craving. We can endure the wanting, the trying to get something or somewhere. Not act on it, not do anything, but endure it. Patiently endure. Like maybe you'd like to get a cup of tea instead of walking. You know, and we can then just notice this craving, this wanting. You know, I've been there, like, mindset, trying to say, like, oh, a cup of tea would be really, really nice right now. And you can get the tea now and then do your walking, right? But we can actually just endure this craving and not act on it. We don't have to listen to these thoughts. Saya Uchitin says, if we are not patient, we can at least make the effort to restrain physical and verbal expressions of impatience. If we observe ourselves closely, however, we will probably find that we are not yet mentally patient. Subtle expressions of our dissatisfaction will escape before we can control ourselves. Maybe you recognize that. You're impatient. For impatient, we can refrain ourselves, not act on it, but often these subtle expressions do kind of escape. Like when we're impatient to maybe talk to retreat coordinator in the office, and there's this other person in front of you, and you might start to feel this impatience building up in your body and mind. You might let out this deep sigh, you know. So we can be attentive to those moments that this dissatisfaction escapes. So, but when we endure it, even if there's a little bit of dissatisfaction escaping, we do weaken this tendency to crave and to be impatient, this tendency of the mind and heart. Every time we decide to not act out our impatience, we make this tendency of the mind just a little weaker. And the same with enduring the undesirable. Sometimes when I sit in meditation, some discomfort in the body arises, like for all of us, probably. And for me, it's usually nothing major, like just some discomfort. And then this urge arises to get rid of the discomfort, to shift the posture, to just get a little bit of relief. But I often choose not to act on it and just to endure the unpleasantness, especially since it's not like harming my body. And in that way, we can start to weaken this tendency to push away the unpleasantness. And so endurance is a really great quality to cultivate, if we can do it with wisdom. And I say that with wisdom because at times it's best not to endure, but to act. Like when we have some injury in the body or some chronic issue is playing up, then it might be better to, you know, take care of the body and change the posture, just to stay with that example. So enduring needs also some wisdom. And the Buddha has a whole paragraph about enduring. He says, "What taints should be abandoned by enduring? Here one, reflecting wisely, bears cold and heat, hunger and thirst, and contact with gadflies, mosquitoes, wind, the sun, and creeping things. One endures ill-spoken, unwelcome words, and arisen bodily feelings that are painful, wrecking, sharp, piercing, disagreeable, distressing, and menacing to life." Okay, might be a little much, but you don't have to endure all of that. But it gets a bit of an idea of what the Buddha thinks of that we can endure, and not only endure, he says we can abandon it by enduring it. So how I interpret it is that we endure the elements like the sun and the wind, the insects and the unwelcome words and stuff. But what happens is not that, you know, those things disappear, you know, that they're not abandoned in a way, but the aversion towards them is what is being abandoned. And enduring other people's unwelcome words is also a really good lesson, to not get all upset and reactive, but patiently and equanimously stay present. And not to say that we should be like a doormat or something, you know, it's not about that, it's about standing up for ourselves if we need to. And then if we do stand up for ourselves, to do this from a place of non-reactivity, place of equanimity and patience. So that was the facet of endurance. And Acharya Dhammapala mentions that patience has the facet of tolerance or non-oppression. And I looked up tolerance, and it has a few different meanings according to the dictionary. One is endurance, I just spoke about that. And then the other one is the act of allowing. And the third one is sympathy for beliefs or practices different from one's own. And I especially like the act of allowing in regard to patience. To me, patience really has this allowing aspect to it. Allowing things just to be the way they are. They don't need to be anything different than they are. Just like we saw with this facet of acceptance. And sometimes when I'm on retreat, I'm standing in line for food, I get this impatience. I want the line to go faster, and I want to get to the food, and, you know, I want to get on with my day. It's really important, you know, I need to get to my nap and stuff. So, you know, and then, of course, there's always this yogi in front of me that's, you know, scooping up the food really slowly, you know, as if we have all day, which we have, but then the impatient the impatient mind doesn't seem to have gotten the memo. So I feel this tension building in my chest, and one thing is to go faster, and the body starts to feel itchy, needing to move, and, you know, at some point I recognize, oh, you know, impatience might be happening. So if I would just have allowed things to be the way they are, then, you know, then the food line is just going as fast as it goes. It's not, you know, anything different. And the yogi in front of me is scooping up as fast as they do, you know. It's just the way it is. It's patience, allowing, tolerance. And that feels much better, you know, just allowing things to be the way they are, not be in contention with reality all the time, you know. So much less suffering. And it's wanting things to be different than they are, the real pervasive tendency that we all have. I once was asked to write a short paragraph about what is the underlying belief that has been central to your suffering. A very uplifting paragraph. So, if you think about it for a moment, what is the underlying belief that has been central to your suffering? I'll give you my answer. Maybe you can think about it for yourself later. I'll read the whole paragraph that I wrote. The underlying belief that has been central to my suffering can be easily summed up in the short phrase, things should be different than they are. Every time this belief pops up, suffering will follow as the cartwheel follows the ox's foot. This belief implies that there is something to get in this world, since else things wouldn't have to be different. When the belief is operating, there is this sense that there is an I that needs things to be a certain way. While in reality, there's no one that needs anything, no one to get anything. And to face the fact, nothing is different than it is. That was my answer. And you can look for yourself. And so much of our suffering comes from the wish that things should be different than they are. You know, when thoughts keep popping up during our meditation, you know, you might get frustrated and might think like, oh, why is this happening to me? I'm such a lousy meditator, I can't do anything right. Or when we experience pain, we might feel aversion, we don't want it to be there. We might feel restless and think we're a terrible meditator, we should be peaceful. You know, these are all things should be different often. And to the extent that we can let things just be the way they are, let the restlessness be there, the aversion, the thoughts, and to the extent that we can let that just be, that determines the extent of our peace, and the extent of our patience and our happiness. There's a very famous quote from Ajahn Chah, you might have heard it. If you let go a little, you will have a little peace. If you let go a lot, you will have a lot of peace. If you let go completely, you will have complete peace. So if you can allow these ups and downs of life to arise and pass away, then our lives would be less wobbly. It wouldn't be swayed by these ups and downs as much. It's like this movement that Anushka made with her arm the other night and talking about the stages of awakening. And then she said, like, once we get to the first stage, it's a little less wobbly. But even if we're not at the first stage yet, our wobbliness can decrease through our practice. And our tendency to be swayed by these ups and downs can decrease, and this wish to want things different than they are can decrease as well. It's through our practice. And so, as we're going into these days of transition, you know, whether this means that you're going home or that you're staying here and new people come in and a new teaching team comes in, you know, keeping an eye out for wanting things to be different than they are. This is a great practice time. And we can really see this tendency of the mind to want things to be different than they are. At one point, I was on retreat here at Spirit Rock, and here at the 2 month. And I saw how I was just constantly wanting things to be different than they are, wanting it not to rain, wanting it to be more silent in the hall, wanting different food, wanting more peace, wanting, you know, no pain. And it just went on all day long, and it's really tiring once I started to see it. And you can investigate for yourself. Is everything exactly okay the way it is right now? Or is there a subtle something that needs to be different? Or maybe a less subtle wanting it to be different? And wanting things to be different than they are in this present moment is like fighting a losing battle. Because the things are the way they are. And part of life is that it is uncontrollable. You know, it is just a series of moments happening one after the other, whether the I likes it or not. And so when we feel that things should be different than they are, we're basically fighting reality. And when we start to investigate this, we can see that this is actually really unpleasant and brings a lot of suffering. And there's a spiritual teacher called Byron Katie. She says, when you argue with reality, you lose, but only 100% of the time. And she encourages us to love what is. And that, I think, is what we're cultivating when we are practicing Vipassana, or insight meditation, and a skill to be with whatever arises. And that is a huge way of cultivating patience, just our normal Vipassana practice. And if in those moments that you do answer that question of are the things okay the way they are with yes, you might recognize that patience is present, and equanimity is present. And then the last thing that Acharya Dhammapala wrote in the quote from the treatise on the Paramis about patience was, seeing things as they really are is the proximate cause for patience to arise. And the word Vipassana sometimes is translated as seeing things as they really are. What does that mean, though, seeing things as they really are? Well, I have to refer back to Anushka again. Seeing things as they are, the three characteristics of existence that Anushka talked about. Anicca, dukkha, anatta. Impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and not self. And when we have a clear understanding of these three aspects of reality, or even one of them, and then we see things as they are, and patience and equanimity will naturally be there. And that's exactly what we're practicing here on the cushion. And we are cultivating our minds to let go of delusion so that we can see these things. And when we are impatient, then there's some sort of distortion going on. We're not clearly seeing the nature of reality. You know, when I, was in this food line, being all worked up about getting on time to my nap, then I wasn't really seeing clearly that this is a moment of impermanence. It's unsatisfactory, it's not self. We might realize, oh, we're not going to be here in line forever. The moment will change. At some point, this yogi's going to be done with scooping their food. And if we see that, then there's no real reason to be impatient. A friend of mine once told me this this story when he was getting lessons to get his driver's license. And he was like, at some point with his instructor, was stuck on this intersection. And just, you know, cars kept coming, and, you know, it seemed to take like forever for him to be able to turn. And his instructor said, no one ever got stuck here before. You know, at some point, we can continue. And often when I am impatient, I think about this example, like, oh yeah, no one ever got stuck here. And we can tune into that, you know, this moment is dukkha, it's unsatisfactory. Might be a bit silly to expect that we can have any satisfaction in this moment. It sounds a bit depressing, but sometimes that can help. Like, why would I want to expect any satisfaction? So sometimes it can be helpful to remind ourselves of the unsatisfactory nature of each moment. And sometimes it's not a good idea, but... And then we can also see that there's no one here, nor there in the other yogi. You know, it's just, you know, a bundle of aggregates scooping up their food. Empty phenomena rolling on, like Munindraji says. And we can see this is an impersonal experience. And we don't have to take it personally. And that makes it much more easy to be equanimous and patient. So Acharya Dhammapala pointed us to these different facets of patience: the acceptance, the enduring, the tolerance, the allowing, the seeing things as they really are. And there's more to patience, though. In the suttas, there are numerous examples of disciples of the Buddha who displayed a lot of patience. And I'll offer a couple. And just as a warning, they're pretty extreme, but I'll make it a bit more relatable afterwards. I'll first go over this first sutta. It's called Advice to Punna in the Majjhima Nikaya. And in this discourse, the Venerable Punna asked advice to the Buddha for practice. And after the Buddha gave advice, the Buddha asked Punna, where are you planning to live? So Punna said, I'm going to live in the Sunaparanta district. So the Buddha then warned Venerable Punna that the people in that area were wild and rough. And he asked Punna a series of questions. He said, Punna, if they abuse you and insult you, what will you think of them? Well, if they abuse me and insult me, I will think, these people of Sunaparanta are gracious, truly gracious, since they don't hit me with their fists. That's what I'll think, Blessed One. That's what I'll think, Holy One. What if they do hit you with their fists? What do you think of them? Well, if they hit me with their fists, I'll think, these people of Sunaparanta are gracious, truly gracious, since they don't throw stones at me. That's what I'll think. But if they do throw stones at you, what will you think of them? Well, if they throw stones at me, I'll think, these people of Sunaparanta are gracious, truly gracious, since they don't beat me with a club. But what if they do beat you with a club? What will you think of them? Well, if they beat me with a club, I'll think, these people of Sunaparanta are gracious, truly gracious, since they don't stab me with a knife. But if they do stab you with a knife, what will you think of them? If they stab me with a knife, I think, these people of Sunaparanta are gracious, truly gracious, since they don't take my life with a sharp knife. But if they do take your life with a sharp knife, what do you think of them? If they take my life with a sharp knife, I'll think, there are disciples of the Buddha who looked for someone to assist with slitting their wrists because they were horrified, repelled, and disgusted with the body and with life. And I have found this without looking. That's what I'll think. Good, good, Puna, says the Buddha. Having such self-control and peacefulness, you will be quite capable of living in Sunapada. Now, Puna, go on your convenience. So he leaves, and soon after he, what do you think, attains full awakening. So what a patience, huh? I guess this might be a bit of a high bar for most of us. But it does point a little bit in the direction of where our practice might be going. You know, it's like I said earlier, if we can't change things, then it might be wiser to accept them, to endure them, to be patient, to be equanimous in the face of difficulty. But of course, I do want to add in that if someone hurts us, we should act if that's the best response. And it reminds me of a story, and the story that Sharon Salzberg once told. I don't know if it's from her book about loving kindness or that I heard it somewhere else, but she was once in India in a rickshaw on her way to her teacher. And then there was this guy and he grabbed her bag, and ran off with it. And then she got to her teacher and she told her teacher like what had just happened. And the teacher said, well, with all the metta in your heart, you should have hit this guy with your umbrella. So, that's what this is about. We can stand up for ourselves. We don't, have to undergo all this hurtfulness, but then with metta in our hearts, from a place of this of patience and equanimity. So what the Buddha points out is not to act from unskillful states of mind, like craving, aversion, delusion. And that, of course, is also a high bar, because we all have craving, aversion, and delusion in us. But our path is to aspire to that. And not to be perfect at it, we can't. What we can do is aspire to it. And the most important thing is to just learn from all the times that we, act from this unskillful state of mind. It's not about not having these unskillful states of mind and, not acting on them, but it's about learning and growing, slowly and steadily, moving in this direction that the Buddha points to in the sutta, the direction of less suffering and more happiness. And there are more examples like the Venerable Puna in the suttas. And there's one famous one, and I thought I'll just throw that one in too, just not to withhold that one. And it goes like this. Even if bandits were to carve you up savagely, limb by limb, with a two-handed saw, he among you who let their heart get angered even at that would not be doing my bidding. Even then, you should train yourself. Our minds will be unaffected, and we will say no evil words. We will remain sympathetic with a mind of goodwill and with no inner hate. This is the simile of the saw, the Majjhima Nikaya. So this is also an extremely high bar, of course. So I think that only beings at the third or fourth stage might be able to do this, awakening, since they uprooted the craving and aversion. So don't feel bad if you can stay all full of metta when bandits are savagely carving you up. So having aversion or even stronger emotions is completely natural. But it's more that these examples are an inspiration. And again, it's not to act. If we can, it's probably you know, best to hit them with our umbrella, you know, these bandits, with the kindness in our hearts if we can. And there's also this Zen teacher, Norman Fisher, who has some interesting ideas about it. And he talks about the Bodhisattva, which is someone aspiring to be a Buddha, which is from a different tradition, but we could see ourselves as practitioners, Bodhisattva practitioners. Bodhisattva practices radical acts of protection, which might sometimes be forceful, but force is avoided, if at all possible, in favor of any gentler method that stands even a slight chance of working. Even where forceful methods seem necessary, they are applied without anger or hatred. But for some of us, these extreme examples from the suttas can be an inspiration, you know, to not get so reactive or upset about the smaller things in life. Like, if these people, you know, can stay calm and patient, you know, with these horrible things being done to them, then maybe I can be patient when someone is breathing heavily, you know? So, you know, we can use this as an inspiration. And this is from that treatise on the Paramis again, Acharya Dhammapala. If there were no wrongdoers, how could I accomplish the perfection of patience? A wrongdoer is also a benefactor, for they are the basis for developing patience. I think that's really beautiful to see wrongdoers as benefactors, you know, as helpers towards accomplishing our Kanti Parami, our patience Parami. You know, like genuinely regarding someone who has hurt us, you know, with a thought, oh, thank you, this gives me the opportunity to practice patience. You know, if you can, I mean, that's not always possible, of course. And then in another sutta, the Buddha says, so then, if others abuse, revile, scold, and harass a practitioner, they understand thus. This painful feeling born of ear contact has arisen in me, that is dependent, not independent. Dependent on what? Dependent on contact. Then one sees that contact is impermanent. Feeling is impermanent. Perception is impermanent. Formations are impermanent. And consciousness is impermanent. And this quote really points to that our internal responses to this unkindness or any other discomfort that might come up is impermanent. So we can see that the moment of contact of the ear and the sound of the unkind words, it's impermanent. And then the feeling tone arising from that contact is impermanent. And then the aversion that follows is impermanent. And of course, you're also welcome to contemplate the dukkha and the not-self aspect of it. The feeling tone and the aversion are not self. They're just arising. Temporary phenomena moving through. So when we are going about this transition phase of the retreat, then there might be some words that we don't like to hear coming up. Words around leaving, words around change happening. We might see sights we don't want to see. Sights of yogis leaving if we're staying, other yogis coming in, new people that we haven't seen before. Or for those leaving, there will be other sites that I won't name. Yeah. And if we notice the unpleasant Vedana of that, and then we can notice the impermanence, the dukkha, the not-self. And the impermanence, the dukkha, the not self of the aversion, the annoyance, maybe sadness, maybe even happiness, you know, frustration, whatever it is. And seeing it like that is the cultivation of patience. And remember that wanting things to be different than they are will lead to suffering. So just be aware of that tendency of wanting things to be different than they are in any moment. I remember sitting the 2-month retreat here and having to go to the transition. I mean, the way I'm phrasing it already is like, you know, I noticed that I was resisting aspects of it. You know, I won't go into any detail. I don't want to plant any ideas in anyone's head. But the resisting, that was really what was making it a bumpy transition for me. And later on, I had another retreat where I went through a transition like that. And not resisting made such a huge difference. It wasn't as bumpy. You know, things are just the way they are, you know. It's just the way it is, and the rest is an add-on. And during the Upekkha meditation yesterday, I gave a simile of the trees not caring if the sun shines or if it's windy, or if it rains, you know, the trees just are. And the trees are, you know, probably not affected by anything that's happening here on the land too much. You know, so maybe we can cultivate that same patience and equanimity as the trees. And just be with whatever unfolds. And when we notice any impatience or aversion, or any type of reactivity, then we can just notice it. You know, we don't have to be perfect. And when we notice it, then the interesting thing is that the mind can start to learn from it in the background. As one of my teachers, Sayadaw Utejaniya, he has a teaching around that. He says that every time we are mindful, we are collecting data points. It's not that we are collecting the data points, but it's the mind, the wisdom aspect of the mind is collecting the data points. And then at some point, eventually, all these data points, you know, the wisdom mind will kind of connect those, and they're, you know, it's like an AI learning system. You know, it's In the background, those points will get connected. And this is not something that we can force or push. You know, our job is just to observe, just to be mindful, whatever is happening. You know, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. And then just let the wisdom mind collect all those data points. And at some point, the wisdom aspect of the mind will come with some insight. You might have had an insight on this retreat or more, one or more. You're like, oh wait, that's the way it is. That's interesting. You know, some release might happen, some wisdom might arise. And this is a process that will happen naturally. The only thing that we need to do is just to keep going. Bhikkhu Bodhi, and he says that there are only 2 mistakes that we can make on this path. And the first is not starting. Well, we've all covered that one, we started. And the second one is to not go all the way. So, your only job is to just keep going. want to end with a quote by Norman Fisher again, the Zen teacher. Just, patience is the most important of all the bodhisattva practices, because without it, all the others will eventually fail. It is easy enough to practice meditation, generosity, ethical conduct, and other wonderful practices when things are going smoothly. But when things fall apart, as they inevitably do from time to time, we revert to old patterns. It's natural to turn away in the face of difficulty. No one wants to go toward pain. We want to go elsewhere, take a break, think of something else. Get rid of it if we can. We distract, deny, blame, or rush around in generally futile attempts to fix somehow. With the practice of patience, we train ourselves to do the opposite, to turn toward the difficulty and embrace it as an ally. So let's just sit for a few moments and let the words settle. It's time for walking now, and the last sit with chanting. You have energy, feel welcome.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.